Good Thursday. I'm Phil Picardi, and this is the NPR News Update podcast. Coming up, St. Paul's schools change procedures in the wake of allegations against a former custodian. Target's new head, Target's a turnaround in Canada. And what do the toys we played with say about us? A look at a new History Center exhibition. First, state officials and business leaders who spearheaded the bid for the 2018 Super Bowl say it's not yet clear how much hosting the game events will cost the public. The NFL awarded the game to Minneapolis earlier this week. Michelle Kelm-Helgen is chair of the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority.
We really have to sit down with the NFL now that we have the bid and really look at the details of what it is that we're looking at, what's required, and determine which pieces the private sector will pay for and what will be covered under the public sector. So we come back next year, work with the legislative leaders, and pass the legislation that would be required.
Planners have also already raised about $30 million in pledges from private sources to pay some of the costs. Governor Dayton says leaders at the state capitol have no implicit or explicit deals with the NFL about funding for events or tax breaks for the league. State law already includes a sales tax exemption on Super Bowl tickets that's worth about $9 million. After years without a planetarium, the Twin Cities will soon get one. Alex Friedrich has more.
The University of Minnesota will break ground on a dozen acres of its St. Paul campus in the spring of next year. The building will hold both a planetarium and a new Bell Museum of Natural History. Steve Berkey, the Bell's advisory board chairman, said up to 120 people will be able to sit under a large dome and watch high-tech presentations on the planets and stars.
You'll be able to travel anywhere in the known universe.
Berkey says the $58 million building will be a little larger than the current museum, which is located on the Minneapolis campus. He says the building should be opened by spring 2017 at the latest. Minneapolis lost its last planetarium when the library that housed it was torn down more than a decade ago. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A national study ranks Minnesota the healthiest state in the nation for adults age 65 and over. The United Health Foundation rated states on 34 individual measures ranging from physical activity to flu vaccines. Elizabeth Stewicki reports.
Dr. Reed Tuckson, senior clinical advisor to the foundation that produced the report, says Minnesota stands out in a number of key indicators. Seniors in the state have the lowest prevalence of cognitive problems. They have access to enough food to eat. They visit the dentist often. And they volunteer. Volunteering itself, he says, plays a major role in senior vitality.
There is a much better chance to be active, to be engaged, to be alive, to feel excited, to be inspired, and therefore to have a good mental attitude as well as other things.
Minnesota nursing home quality also ranked high. The research is an effort to understand the major health problems that will arise as the number of seniors balloons due to the aging of the baby boom generation. Elizabeth Stewicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Secretary of State Mark Ritchie says his office will no longer print or distribute legislative privilege cards. Tim Pugmire has more.
Ritchie said his decision was based on a lack of statutory requirement to issue the cards, which were highlighted during this year's unsuccessful attempt to pass a bill to clarify legislative immunity. Some thought the cards would allow lawmakers to avoid arrest. DFL Representative Ryan Winkler of Golden Valley said Ritchie took an important step, but he still wants a legislative fix next year.
I think we need to have a state statute that clarifies that legislators have no immunity from arrest in criminal matters, and we need to put this issue to bed once and for all.
The House overwhelmingly passed the bill, but it stalled when the Senate did not take a vote. Opponents there said the law already allows police to arrest legislators. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
The Minnesota Supreme Court has upheld the driver's license revocation of a Monticello woman who says she drove drunk to flee an abusive husband. Here's Matt Sepik.
Jennifer Axelberg says her husband hit her and took her phone while they were at a cabin drinking in 2011. Axelberg drove to a resort less than a mile away where she was arrested on suspicion of DWI. Axelberg argued her license shouldn't have been revoked because she was fleeing danger and it was necessary for her to drive. But DWI attorney Charles Ramsey, who filed a friend of the court brief in the case, says Minnesota law does not allow for a so-called necessity defense.
People who have to drive out of necessity, where their life is in danger, after they've been drinking, risk losing their license and all of the collateral consequences that go along with that.
In her opinion, Justice Lori Gilday said changing the law is the business of the legislature, not the courts. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A former Hastings priest is facing criminal charges for allegedly abusing an altar boy in the late 1980s and early 90s. Peter Cox has the report.
63-year-old Francis Hefkin was a priest at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. Hefkin turned himself into police and was charged in Dakota County Court with two counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct. Dakota County Attorney James Backstrom says state statute allows sexual crimes against child victims to be prosecuted within 3 years of the victim's initial report to police, regardless of when the crime occurred.
These disturbing memories will often come bubbling back up to the surface once again at some point in time in their lives. And when they do, these victims who are now adults deserve a chance at justice.
The same adult victim filed a civil suit against Hefkin, the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis, the Order of St. Benedict, and the St. Luke Institute in November, the same month he reported the decades-old abuse to police. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
St. Paul school officials have revised procedures for dealing with allegations of sexual misconduct in the light of new charges against a former custodian. Walter Happel, who resigned from the district in February, already faced a charge that he spied on an 11-year-old boy in a school bathroom. Now, a number of other students have come forward with similar allegations, and Happel also faces charges he sexually assaulted a young relative and a neighbor boy in the 1980s. Curtis Gilbert told Tom Cran all about it.
What is the St. Paul School District saying?
The district released a statement saying that it is concerned and disturbed by the new charges detailing Happel's alleged misconduct against seven children over three decades, both in and out of school. The statement said, quote, "We are sorry and feel terribly that this had happened, though we know this is nothing compared to how our families feel." The principal at the school where Happel worked most recently also emailed parents today. He told them that Linwood Monroe Arts Plus Elementary will get security upgrades in the coming weeks, in addition to the policy changes being made at the school district level.
And tell us more, what are these policy changes?
Well, there's a bunch of them. They're retraining staff about their legal responsibility to report suspected sexual misconduct to police. There are multiple instances in the charges where prosecutors say school employees were made aware of allegations against Happel but didn't report them to police.
Mm-hmm.
There's another change that principals will routinely walk through every room in the buildings, their school buildings, to make sure nothing is awry. The original charge against Happel in March alleged that there was a secret room in the school where he kept testosterone pills and an intensifying gel. When new allegations are made in the future, the school says it will review whether there has been a history of similar type complaints, because as we noted, the allegations against Happel date way back, and the district is considering instituting periodic recurring background checks for all employees.
Now, could any school district employees who failed to report allegations here or in other cases face charges themselves?
Well, so far, no charges have been filed against anyone but Happel, but those questions are part of the investigation that's underway right now. If there were other people charged, those charges would actually come out of Dakota County, it turns out, and that's to eliminate any possible conflict of interest with the case against Happel in Ramsey County.
And Happel made his first appearance in Ramsey County Court today, correct, since these charges were filed? Tell us what happened at the hearing.
Well, they set bail for him at $245,000, and that is the amount that prosecutors were seeking. Happel's lawyer called it exorbitant, but the judge said given the extreme seriousness of some of these charges, Happel would potentially have an incentive to flee. The judge also ordered Happel not to have contact with any of his alleged victims.
So Happel faces charges involving kids at the schools where he worked, but also kids he knew in his private life as well. Let's go over some of those allegations.
Okay, well as several of the in-school allegations are actually similar to the one he faced in March that he had peeped on students in the bathroom. But there are these more serious allegations that we noted earlier that he actually sexually abused young relatives outside schools and others, in fact. Police actually investigated one of those accusations back in 1991, but didn't find enough evidence to file charges. And now some of Happel's relatives say they had lied to police about the abuse back then, and his own son is one of those who's now recanting earlier statements he made to police.
And what has Happel himself said about these allegations, if anything?
Well, he hasn't entered a plea for any of these new charges. In court today, I watched as he shook his head side to side as prosecutors detailed some of the allegations against him. Happel has pleaded not guilty to that initial charge of surreptitious interference with privacy, is what it's called. When he was questioned by police, he denied peeking at the boy in the bathroom stall. He said he was checking to see if there was a mess on the floor.
Curtis Gilbert, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Curtis and Tom Cran on All Things Considered and the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Richfield-based Best Buy was profitable in its first quarter, but it's still struggling. Martin Moylan reports.
Richfield-based Best Buy says a big tax break and cost-cutting helped the company post net earnings of $461 million for the quarter that ended earlier this month. A year ago, the consumer electronics retailer lost $81 million during the same period. But total sales fell 3% to $9 billion. That's the ninth consecutive quarter of year-over-year sales declines. Best Buy has been facing intense price competition from online merchants such as Amazon.com and powerful discounters like Walmart. Under CEO Hubert Joly's Renew Blue initiative, the company has revamped stores, cut costs, and ramped up price matching. But that hasn't turned around sales, and the company expects more sales declines this year as the consumer electronics industry remains weak and people wait for the introduction of new smartphones and tablets. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Marty is one of NPR's business reporters. He's also been following the Target story. The theft of customer data has been a big headache for Minneapolis-based Target and the subject of lots of headlines. But as Marty reports, the retailer's earnings from the first quarter show the fallout from the data breach is just one challenge facing Target.
The retailer's net income slid 16% from a year ago, dipping to $418 million. Operating losses in Canada that topped $200 million accounted for the bulk of the decline. Data breach costs, by contrast, represented a hit of only $18 million. In a conference call with analysts, interim CEO John Mulliken said it's too early to determine the total financial impact of the breach on Target once lawsuits, fraud, and other claims are settled. But company surveys indicate shoppers who spurned Target because of the breach are coming back. Still, sales at U.S. stores open at least 1 year fell 0.3%. Customer traffic in the U.S. started slipping a year and a half ago, long before the customer data theft. Why? Many consumers are still closely watching their spending, and Mulliken admits Target has lost some of its cachet.
We need to improve on something we've historically done well: delivering unique products and services at great prices. We are working quickly to drive more newness in our merchandising and presentation, helping to keep Target top of mind with guests by continually reminding them why they fell in love with Target in the first place.
Fixing the Canadian operations is also a top priority. Losses there now top $1 billion. The debacle in the Great North likely played a role in the firing of CEO Greg Steinhoffel, as well as the head of Target's Canadian operations. Mulliken insists Canada will be fixed.
Canada is a great market, and Target is a great retailer. But so far, we have not lived up to our potential or our expectations. We made changes to the Target Canada leadership team so they could take a hard look at our current performance and apply fresh thinking about how to improve.
There's a lot of room for improvement. Anthony Karabas is president of the Hilco Retail Consulting Practice in Toronto.
They've opened 124 stores in 1 year, which is pretty incredible. On the other hand, I think they've had tremendous difficulties getting their supply chain right and being in stock with the right items in the right places at the right time. There's a tremendous amount of out of stocks. I think the other thing that they've also not gotten right is their pricing has not been sharp enough for Canada, where people feel like it's overpriced.
Target also plans to work on becoming more competitive online, investing to make its web and mobile internet sites more compelling and better integrated with Target's store operations. Currently, Target's online channels generate only about 3% of sales. Morningstar retail analyst Ken Perkins says Target needs to upgrade its e-commerce efforts to win over customers who shop primarily or exclusively at Amazon.com or other web-only retailers.
Convincing customers that it's worth more than just shopping at a competitor that's a pure play online competitor is going to be a tough challenge, but it seems like that's what they're addressing.
As part of that effort, Target will soon start offering same-day home delivery of some items in Minneapolis and other markets. There'll be a $10 fee for their service. Edward Jones retail analyst Brian Yarbrough says all the fixes and upgrades will mean lower profits for Target, but he says that's a price the company has to pay.
You got the lower prices to drive customers in it, and we're seeing that. If you look at their circulars on Sunday, I think they need to do that to get the customer back in the door in the U.S. and then in Canada. They got to fix their supply chain issues and get more product on the shelves because there's still a lot of empty spots, and then continue to invest in e-commerce because that's kind of the wave of the future for retail.
The data breach may have been behind a quarterly decline in customers using Target-branded credit and debit cards to make purchases. The percentage of Target sales paid for with red cards dropped by half a percentage point to about 20%. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Toys bring back some strong childhood memories. A new exhibit opening tomorrow at the Minnesota History Center, Toys of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, lets visitors explore those memories and what they tell us about culture. Kathy Werzer got a preview with senior exhibit developer Kate Roberts.
Slinkies were supposed to walk down the stairs. I could never do this as a kid, so you want to try this with me? All right, ready? One, two, three. How's that? Okay, I won the slinky race.
You won the slinky race. I'm proud to say it.
In addition to the slinky on the stairs, visitors can actually play with a barrel full of monkeys and take out their aggressions in the Nerf garage. Robert says you can also learn a lot about the history of toys.
The slinky, like so many toys, actually was invented by a man who wasn't a toy designer. He was a mechanical engineer, and literally a copper coil rolled off the table, and he thought to himself, I think I've got something here. So Richard James and his wife founded James Industries to make this slinky.
You go from 50s, 60s through the 70s. Walk us through some of the high points. Say, we'll start with the 50s.
Well, when you think of the 50s, I think a lot of people will probably think coonskin caps, Fess Parker. The other thing that people will remember is Mickey Mouse Club and the rise of TV advertising in the 50s. You move to the 60s, you can't help but think about Barbie and G.I. Joe, I think, but there's also an awful lot going on in the 60s, too, with board games, with science toys, with educational toys. Move into the 70s, and that's the rise of electronics. And that's, by the end of the decade, that's really what's taking over.
Do you have some of your own personal collection here?
I actually do. I have a couple of things in the exhibit. My beloved ViewMaster. And I can't say enough about that toy and how many years I spent. And for people who might not remember the ViewMaster, it's a little viewer thing where you put in slides, and they were 3D. So you could see this wonderful world in 3D. And the things that I particularly liked, of course, were the Disney slides. But there was everything. There were birds. There were monuments. You could see the world through this little ViewMaster.
As we're surrounded by these toys, some people might remember things like Cootie and Barrel of Monkeys and that kind of thing. But those were made locally?
Yeah, there are so many local companies we discovered in doing this work. Cootie is one of the best known, of course, made by Shopper Toys. But Lakeside Toys based in Minneapolis, made a couple of toys that are very popular, Barrel of Monkeys, and what about Gumby and Pokey? That's an iconic toy from the 60s. Lakeside took the concept, which was something that was actually a claymation series from the 50s, but then they took the toy and made that iconic bendable toy, one of the first truly successful bendy toys.
Let's talk a little bit about how toys reflect culture. You mentioned in the 60s you had space toys and that kind of thing. What can you tell about a culture through its playthings?
I think you can tell a great deal about culture through playthings. You mentioned the toys of the 60s, the rise of NASA. Well, starting in the 50s, actually, when Sputnik is launched in 1957. And so then we start seeing a real emphasis on science kits, chemistry kits, training children to be engineers and scientists, to be able to compete in a worldwide economy, in a worldwide marketplace. Go to the 60s, we've got the space race continuing, culminating, of course, with putting the man on the moon in 1969. And we've got so many NASA toys, so many, both very realistic and also fanciful robots.
There are complicated toys in this exhibit, but have you noticed that there are some very simple toys?
This is one of the strains that went through all of our research and all of our thinking about this exhibit is, you know, there is the material culture of toys, but there are also the power of a child's imagination. And you think about toys that really foster that imagination. Think about the building toys of the era, the Legos, the Lincoln Logs, the Tinker Toys. Imagination is a powerful thing. And the other thing that we find throughout this exhibit is that the way that manufacturers intended toys to be used and the way that kids actually play with them isn't always the same, of course. A child's imagination can take a toy in wonderful ways.
Well, thanks for racing Slinkies with me here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming.
Kate Roberts is the senior exhibit developer for Toys of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The exhibit opens Saturday, runs through January 4th at the Minnesota History Center in St. Paul. There's also a book about toys of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. To see five iconic toys born right here in Minnesota, go to our website, mprnews.org.
Kate Roberts and Kathy Werzer at the Minnesota History Center. And that's the NPR News update for this Thursday, May 22nd. I'm Phil Picardi. I'm hosting Morning Edition tomorrow, so John Wanamaker will have the podcast with all the Friday news.